This lecture is brought to you by Knox Theological Seminary on iTunes U. Knox is a seminary in the tradition of the Reformation that exists to educate men and women to declare and demonstrate the gospel of Jesus Christ. Our prayer is that this teaching will be beneficial in your Christian life and ministry.
The formation of the Old Testament. What we have today is the Old Testament. And this, of course, was a long-standing debate in the history of the church. It still is to some degree, because the books that we call the Apocrypha are not accepted by the Protestant churches, but they are by the Roman Catholic Church and, of course, by the Eastern Orthodox churches as well. So there is a discrepancy here. However, in modern times, one of the benefits of modern scholarship is that people have come together on this much more than they once did. The origin of the dispute over the books, the apocryphal books, really has nothing to do with the Reformation. I mean, it's in its modern form, it looks that way, but actually not. It goes back much earlier than this. To a debate around the year 400 between Jerome, who was a Roman writer who translated the Bible into Latin. Jerome was the great translator of the Latin text, which is known today as the Vulgate, the Biblia Vulgata. Vulgate means simply popular. The standard popular version. And Jerome was one of the very few people in the ancient world who learned Hebrew. He actually took the trouble to learn Hebrew. And he translated the Old Testament from the Hebrew into Latin, not from the Greek, which was a very unusual thing to do in those days. So not surprisingly, you will discover that he was a partisan of the Hebrew text. He didn't think that the Greek translation should be used at all. This was countered by his great contemporary Augustine, the famous Augustine of Hippo, who said, well, the Septuagint, the Greek translation, was the Bible of the apostles, and therefore we ought to take its text, including these extra books, even though they were not quoted in the New Testament, they're nevertheless part of the Septuagint, and so they should be included as part of the Old Testament as well. And it was Augustine whose views won out in the end. At least in the Roman Catholic Church. But at the time of the Reformation, the reformers plumped for Jerome. I mean, and they said so. I mean, they said this debate between Jerome and Augustine, we side with Jerome because he was a better scholar, a better biblical scholar than Augustine was. And that is undoubtedly true. I mean, whatever you say about the canon of Scripture, undoubtedly Jerome knew more about it than Augustine did. And as I say, he took the trouble to learn Hebrew, which is a remarkable thing. What it raises, though, for us is the question of the so-called canon. The word canon means simply rule, standard, the standard by which we measure, the yardstick by which we measure everything else. And who came up with this idea? Did the Jews or the priests in the temple have some concept of this? I mean, did they look at a book as it came along and said, well, does this fit with the rule, you see, the standard that we ought to use? And if it did, or if they thought like that, what was this standard? Where do we find it? How do we know, what the criteria were for including a book in the canon or not? The trouble, of course, here, and this is where we really do have a problem today, is that we simply don't know. I mean, the inner workings of the Jerusalem temple were secret. Well, I'll say they were secret, but they're just not known to us today. I mean, did they sit down in a committee and decide? Well, maybe, you know. We can't say one way or the other how this happened. It's hidden from our eyes. What we can say, however, is that really there is no Hebrew literature. There are no Hebrew books that have survived apart from the Old Testament. We know that some were written because they're mentioned in the Old Testament from time to time, but whatever they were, and you know, they've disappeared. So that apart from a few inscriptions on the wall, you know, like David was here, sort of thing, scratched in various stones, we don't really have any Old Testament Hebrew. You know, it's just the Old Testament. That's it. There's no other Hebrew really to compare it with. And so, whether there was a lot of Hebrew literature lying around that was rejected or not, it is extremely hard to say. It's at least possible that things weren't written down. Unless they were meant to be preserved as scripture, the whole idea of writing, you know, was more or less confined to scripture. And here, the Dead Sea Scrolls are no help, because the Dead Sea Scrolls, which come, of course, from the time of Jesus, don't have any of these things either. So you might think, you know, that if they were anywhere, they'd be there, but they're not. And so that's another question, you see. I mean, maybe people did write these books, but did they preserve them? Presumably not, you know, in some way or other. So it's a very difficult question to answer for the Old Testament. All we can say is that Jesus and his disciples clearly did accept them. It's not true that every Old Testament book is quoted in the New Testament. That's not true. But there's no suggestion that anything had to be, you know, got rid of, or that anything was wrong or anything like that. So we can more or less assume that that was the case. When it comes to the New Testament, however, the formation of the New Testament, we're in a very different situation. First of all, unlike the Old Testament, the New Testament was the product of a single generation. The Old Testament was written over several hundred years. How many hundred, of course, depends on what you think about the origins. It may be up to 1,000 years that went into the planning of the or the composition of the Old Testament. But the New Testament, you know, was composed, was in existence within a generation of the death and resurrection of Jesus. This is in itself important. It's important because it underlies one of the basic contentions of our faith, which is that all Christians have the same faith. You see, the danger would be that if there was scripture being produced, say, 200 years after the time of Jesus, those who lived before then would not have had access to this. And so the question would arise, well, did they not have this information? Did they not know this? Why wasn't it written down, you know, at an earlier time? And this issue, although it may seem obscure to you and me today, was actually an important one in the early church, because there were people who went around saying, there's a secret tradition. The apostles didn't tell us everything they knew, you know. There are things that the apostles kept quiet about. And I'm producing this now. You know, I've dug it up. And I'm going to tell you now what it is. Now, this kind of thing happens today. You know, people discover the secret diaries of Adolf Hitler, for instance, which then turn out to be false. People, you know, make things, well, they give testimony of things that happened, you know, years and years ago, and you say to yourself, well, did this really happen or not? It's extremely difficult because one of the reasons we have statutes of limitations is because of this. I mean, people's memories start to fail. And can you rely on what people say, even if they're eyewitnesses, something that happened a very, very long time ago? I mean, how reliable is their memory? And so this is one factor that we have to bear in mind. The other thing, of course, is that the inner dynamic of the New Testament is that we live in the last days, that Jesus is the fulfillment of the revelation. And therefore, the witness to Jesus and his work and so on is the culmination of the revelation to Israel. There is nothing further to be said. And so once you get beyond, I mean, you can imagine, Jesus, of course, didn't write anything himself, but you can imagine those who were eyewitnesses, those who knew what had happened, who'd seen it and so on, when that generation died off, when they passed away, there was nobody left to say what had really happened. I mean, they didn't have that authority. Now, we know this because the Apostle Paul, you see, was in a delicate position here. Paul wrote a substantial chunk of what is now the New Testament, depending on how you count and so on. I mean, whether he wrote half the books, I suppose he did, but it's not half the amount of material. It's more like maybe 20% or something of the whole of the material in the New Testament, but still, it's a significant portion of it. And the difficulty with Paul, of course, is that he was not a disciple of Jesus. Quite the opposite, in fact, And so he had difficulty defending his right to be an apostle. I mean, who was he? Or where did this man come from? And why was he claiming this authority? And so it's Paul who tells us, what an apostle is and how you sort of define this. And one of the criteria is someone who has seen the risen Christ. And Paul qualified for this because Jesus had appeared to him on the road to Damascus. And he tells us this himself. He says, as one who was born out of due time, Christ also appeared to me. But this was entirely exceptional. However, it's a reminder to us that there was a sense in the early church, in the first generation of Christians, that seeing the risen Christ, having had this direct experience of him and his resurrection, did matter. It was an important thing that had to be taken into consideration. And so it's not surprising, that the writings of the New Testament all belong to this first generation of witnesses. Now, of course, we could sit here all day and argue about priority. Did Mark come before Matthew? What about John? Where do the Gospels fit? And so on. People argue back and forth over this. As far as the early church is concerned, we don't have to worry too much about it. We know that the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were all accepted as authentic witnesses of the apostolic deposit. And went back to what the apostles themselves had seen and preached about the teaching of Jesus. How do we know that? Well, one of the curiosities, this is very, very interesting about this, is that the people who tell us this tell us this more or less by accident. There is a man called Tatian who lived sometime in the middle of the second century. It's not entirely sure or clear when, but around the year 150 or something like this, maybe before that. And Tatian had a problem. Tatian did not like the idea that there was more than one gospel, because he thought, well, there's only one message. I mean, Jesus was one person with one life, with one teaching. So why do we have different witnesses to this? So what Tatian decided to do to simplify things was to collect together the Gospels that were circulating and reduce them to one. combine them into a single text. Now, this is a rather interesting thing to do because, of course, you say to yourself, well, what texts did Tatian pick up? And we know that he picked up Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, those four. And he said, these are the four which are going around, and these are the four which need to be cut down into one. So in this rather curious way, we discover that as far as Tatian was concerned, there were four Gospels. Now, he didn't necessarily recognize them as canonical as we would understand that now, because, of course, if he had, he wouldn't have dared try to reduce them to one. You know, I mean, he wouldn't have been able to touch them in the way that he did. So there's an argument about that. But the fact is that he took those four and nothing else. You see, nothing else that was going around is indicative of the fact that the four Gospels as we know them had already established themselves in the life and worship of the church. Now, if this was true around the year 150, it must have been true at that time for quite a while. I mean, Tatian wouldn't have just come across this, a year or two before he decided to do this. It must have been something that had been ongoing for some time. And so we can probably push back, what Tatian was doing, at least a generation. We are helped in this by another rather odd person called Marcion, who lived probably slightly earlier than Tatian. I mean, again, there's debates about, when exactly he was around, but in the early part of the second century. And Marcion had another difficulty. He didn't want any Jewish influence in the New Testament, because he thought that the Jewish God was an inferior deity, that Judaism was an inferior religion. And so he wanted to edit the New Testament to take out all references to Jews and Judaism. Well, this was a very difficult thing to do, of course, but the fact that he attempted it is interesting to us because he again was dealing with four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The difference is that whereas Tatian tried to combine them, Tatian didn't reject the witness of any one of them. Marcion, in effect, rejected Matthew, Mark, and John and stuck with Luke. He thought Luke was the only really authentic gospel. But the fact that he tells us this, you see, it says this, so the other three are no good, you just take this one, is again a kind of backhanded acknowledgement that these four were in use in the church at that time. They were regarded as canonical by people who were actually reading them and preaching and teaching from them. And with this, of course, we are taken back into the time where we are still in contact with living memory of Jesus himself. There would still have been people around in the church who had known the Apostle John. Well, there were. We know that. Who, when they were young, they had sat at the feet of John the Apostle when John was an old man. And so this brings us into direct contact, with the witness itself. And, of course, John is one of the main authors of the New Testament material. So we get quite close, really, to the sources in this way. You see, that's an important thing. We also know that the books of the New Testament are somehow or other linked to an apostle. They aren't all written by apostles, but if they're not written by apostles, they're written by people who are closely associated with the apostles. Like Luke, for instance, who was a traveling companion of Paul, and clearly was writing you know, around the same time and in the same way. I mean, we don't know for sure, but we know that Luke was in Rome with Paul when he was imprisoned there, and he probably was writing the Acts of the Apostles around that time, because they end with Paul's imprisonment in Rome. And you would think, you see, if Luke had been writing after Paul's death, that he would have said that. You know, he would have gone on, why does he stop where he stops? Probably because that was the situation that was existing when he was writing, you know. And so you get some, you know, notion of this at that particular time. So you get indications like this, you see, of how these books came into being and how they were used in the church. The letters of Paul sent to the various churches, and indeed the other letters, I mean, Peter, James, and so on, what authority did they have? This, again, is very difficult. We don't really know who collected them or why they were preserved. The curious thing is the only indication we have in Paul's writings that another church should read one of his letters comes in Colossians chapter 4 at the end, where he said, you know, share your letter with the church at Laodicea and read the letter that I've written to them. Very interesting, because we don't know what the letter was he wrote to them. So how come the letter to the Colossians have survived, but the letter to the Laodiceans hasn't? Unless, of course, you say that a book like Ephesians, a letter like Ephesians, may have been the letter to the, to Laodicea. You know, it's not entirely clear. That's possible. So, you know, maybe we do have the letter to the Laodiceans, we just don't know that, you know, that was what it was. But anyway, that's another issue. Nevertheless, you see, the apostolic writings clearly were preserved in some way and were circulated beyond the confines of the churches to whom they were written. Now, this is important because it's a reminder to us that although the letters of Paul, or the letters of the apostles generally, were written to address specific circumstances, it's because a problem had arisen in some church or other that Paul wrote to it, you know, to sort things out. The underlying principles which are expounded in the letters transcend the circumstances in which they were written. And this is something we have to bear in mind, because, you see, you could say to yourself, well, if Paul wrote to Corinth, you know, full of advice about this, that, and the other, why is this preserved? You know, why should we have this now? Because the circumstances in which the letter was written no longer apply. I mean, you know, your church and my church is not the same as the church at Corinth. It may have other problems, but I mean, we've moved on from that particular situation. Our churches are not divided between Jewish and Gentile believers. I mean, so Galatians and Romans, you know, the circumstances which provoked Paul to write them no longer obtain. I mean, where would you find a church today which is divided in this way? I mean, there are churches which are divided, yes, but not over things like eating meat sacrificed to idols. You know, I mean, this is not an issue in anybody's church today. So, in dealing with the epistles, the New Testament epistles, we have to face the fact that they were written to address particular situations which no longer obtain now, you know, in that way. But, of course, the interesting thing about them is that they have survived because their message transcends the situation in which they were written. And this is the key, you see. This is not true, of course, just of them. This is true of any great literature or anything like this. I mean, it you know, things survive because they speak to circumstance. They speak to people beyond the circumstances in which they were originally written. And this again is a reminder to you of what I said earlier at the beginning, that what we're reading in the New Testament is not primarily the story of the church at Corinth or the church at Rome or whatever it is. I mean, that comes in incidentally. But the message of the gospel which Paul was preaching. And this, if you read through the letters, this is what it is. You see, Paul says, well, I came to you, I preached the message, this is what I said, now you've turned away from this, I need to bring you back to the core. This is what, you know, you've gone astray in this way, that way, the other way, I have to call you back. And of course, it's this aspect which helped to preserve the letters, because it was felt that never mind the circumstances in which they were originally composed. I mean, that's fine, you know, we know about that, but there's a message here which goes deeper than that, which goes beyond that, and which is worth preserving and maintaining and preaching to subsequent generations who may be living in different circumstances, but nevertheless they need to hear the same fundamental message. You see, and this is what kept these letters in circulation in the life of the church.
These courses provide a glimpse into our academic programs. Knox students can take 1 week or semester-length courses in person at our South Florida campus, or choose to complete a degree entirely online. By bringing together academic excellence, a vibrant community of learning, and flexible scheduling, Knox offers today's students timeless truth through modern convenience. For more information about earning credit toward a master's degree, please visit our website at knoxseminary.edu.